Chiefs of Staff upon his return from the executive committee meeting on November 27th. Perhaps in deference to Taylor, his old boss and mentor, Wheeler had not pressed the JCS view during the meeting. He may also have recognized the futility of doing so. The chairman reported to his colleagues that they alone advocated option B. Although the chiefs decided to continue recommending a hard knock, they again made it clear that they would agree to the gradual application of force in exchange for a commitment to use whatever force became necessary to assure South Vietnam's freedom and independence. Planning responsibility remained with William Bundy's working group after Taylor's arrival. Bundy and his colleagues were too preoccupied with conflicting political priorities to consider adequately military issues such as the level of force necessary to affect the enemy's will and ability to continue the war. They had to weigh at every point possible reactions of the U.S. Congress, the Saigon, Hanoi, and Beijing governments, and American and international opinion. After the November 28th meeting, William Bundy drafted a National Security Action Memorandum that detailed 30 days of Phase 1 immediate actions, followed by a second phase consisting of graduated military pressures directed systematically against North Vietnam. Taylor, McNaughton, Rusk, and Forrestal reviewed Bundy's memo. The draft National Security Action Memorandum was ready to go to the president on November 29th. McNaughton developed and McNamara approved an appendix to the memorandum entitled Graduated Military Pressure and Related Actions, which included time-phased military actions such as air deployments, bombing targets, and the numbers of sorties required per target. The JCS did not contribute to this document. William Bundy thought McNaughton's impressive array of facts on available forces represented the best thinking available. The Joint Chiefs did not recommend changes to the substance of Bundy's memo. In fact, General Wheeler asked only that in the discussion of U.S. operations in Laos, the phrase armed reconnaissance be changed to airstrikes so as not to preclude attacks on bridges. The chiefs approved the document because it held out the promise of future action and indicated that the president would escalate the level of military activities. In fact, on November 30th, Taylor told the JCS that the rate of escalation under option C was ambiguous and speculated that it might shift quickly to the hard knock. The memo stated that America's policy objective in Vietnam to secure an independent, non-communist South Vietnam was unchanged. The document did not list fallback objectives. It permitted airstrikes on all 94 targets recommended by the JCS, as well as aerial mining of North Vietnamese ports and a naval blockade of North Vietnam. The chief supported the memo, furthermore, because the draft that they reviewed included a paragraph describing the hard knock. They were naturally under the impression that the Bundy memo that the president received contained this information. They were misled. Prior to submitting the memo to the president, McNamara removed the description of the hard knock. William Bundy later explained that this excision was natural because the president's other advisors had reached a crucial consensus and the JCS position was without institutional support. According to Bundy, the JCS were lucky that their proposal survived as long as it did, because it had already been completely accepted that the military elements of any bombing program would be gradual in character. Bundy said that the consensus that had formed slowly over a long time had finally moved out into the open. General Wheeler had his only opportunity to propose the hard knock during a December 1st meeting with the President, Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey, and the executive committee members. When his turn came to speak, Wheeler told Johnson that the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended sharp military actions, including the destruction of the Fukien MiG fighter base, other airfields, and the major petroleum facilities in 3 days. These initial attacks would establish the fact that the U.S. intends to use military force, if necessary, to the full limits of what military force can contribute to achieving U.S. objectives in Southeast Asia. Airstrikes would then continue on infiltration targets in North Vietnam and expand eventually to areas throughout the country. Wheeler stated that the program could be suspended short of full destruction of North Vietnam if our objectives were earlier achieved. Wheeler reported the chief's judgment that solving the conflict in Vietnam would ultimately require a greater level of force than that proposed in the Bundy Committee's Option C. He read the following passage verbatim from a sheet of paper. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recognize that any course of action we adopt, except early withdrawal from South Vietnam, could develop eventually into the course they advocate. This fact reinforces our belief that we should profit by the several advantages of forthright military action initiated upon our decision. In other words, if we must fight a war in Southeast Asia, let us do so under conditions favorable to us from the outset and with maximum volition resting with the United States. By all accounts, Wheeler did not present the chief's position forcefully. He did not dissent from the Bundy memo. He did not highlight the chief's disagreement with the consensus policy. He did not confront President Johnson with the things he feared: division among his advisors and the possibility that the country would learn that the chief dissented from the policy choices he favored. Wheeler's presentation of the chief's position preserved a facade of consultation between the president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before Wheeler first spoke, the president had already approved the consensus position of his civilian advisors. After Wheeler gave the JCS position, however, Johnson expressed agreement with several points and appeared amenable to tougher military action. He seemed to leave open the degree to which he was willing to commit military force and concurred with Wheeler's statement that military action should aim to preserve maximum volition. The president indicated that he was reluctant to take immediate military action due to the instability of the South Vietnamese government and the precarious position of American civilian dependents living in South Vietnam, but he pledged a willingness to reconsider Wheeler's proposal at a later time. Just prior to the end of the meeting, LBJ reassured Wheeler that if the situation did not improve, "I'll be talking to you, General." On his return to the Pentagon, Wheeler reported to LeMay and the other chiefs that the president had essentially opted for the chief's option C prime, or fallback proposal. Although the president and his advisors had rejected the hard knock for the present, it seemed likely that the JCS would eventually secure approval for the level of military force they advocated. Wheeler noted that no one at the meeting questioned the importance of Southeast Asia or the validity of U.S. objectives there, as the JCS had defined them. Yet, the JCS and the civilian presidential advisors had not resolved their fundamental disagreement over the objectives that the United States was pursuing in Vietnam or over the level of military force that the president was willing to commit to the war. On December 3rd, Johnson again met with his advisors to approve the executive committee's two-phase plan for slowly deepening America's involvement in the war. On the same day, the president gave Taylor final instructions before the ambassador departed for Saigon. He put tremendous pressure on the ambassador to make improvements in the South Vietnamese government, a task that Taylor had described as virtually impossible. LBJ emphasized that the South Vietnamese government would have to meet minimum criteria of performance before the United States attacked North Vietnam. In short, the Saigon government had to maintain control of the population while the military remains subordinate and responsive to civil authority. Specifically, Taylor should instruct the South Vietnamese government to increase the size and effectiveness of its armed forces and police, replace incompetent commanders and civilian officials, broaden the civic action program, demonstrate progress in pacification, and, finally, carry out a sanitary cleanup of Saigon. The president authorized Taylor to begin joint planning for airstrikes against the North to show the South Vietnamese leaders that the United States was willing to reward them with bombing runs on North Vietnam if they satisfied the American criteria for an effective government. It was time to quit talking and go to work, the president announced. Johnson's reluctance to approve a bombing program ran deeper than his concern over the stability of the South Vietnamese government. Vietnam was demanding his attention when he could least afford to give it. Preoccupied with putting the finishing touches on his Great Society program for the next Congress, Johnson planned to push 150 bills in as many days. From his long experience in the House and Senate, he knew that he had to win congressional support for this program in the first year of his presidency, when his influence was greatest. Vietnam must not divert congressional or public attention from the Great Society. He moved to obscure the depth of the difficulties in Vietnam and to minimize the significance of Taylor's visit. Although Johnson had already authorized air raids against Laos, an intensification of reconnaissance flights over North Vietnam, and U.S.-South Vietnamese joint planning for airstrikes into North Vietnam, he was anxious to keep these decisions from the American people. He ordered that the National Security Action Memorandum be issued as a less conspicuous policy paper and decreed that the word XCOM no longer be used to describe the executive committee or the group of Vietnam advisors. The State Department press release about Taylor's visit quoted his reporting an increase in the strength of the South Vietnamese armed forces rather than publicizing his pessimistic assessment of affairs in Saigon. The president attempted to conceal from the American public the difficulties in the South Vietnamese armed forces and the gains in Viet Cong strength. On McNamara's recommendation, he removed from a draft of an official White House statement an announcement that the State Department would soon release a study of increased infiltration from North Vietnam. Johnson told his advisors on December 1st that he would shoot at sunrise anyone who leaked information on infiltration to the public. Lyndon Johnson knew how dramatically any action against North Vietnam would contrast with his position during the election. Only 2 months prior to the December meetings, he told a crowd in Manchester, New Hampshire, that his administration would start dropping bombs only as a last resort, and that he planned to get them, the South Vietnamese, to save their own freedom with their own men. In November 25th, New York Times editorial reminded readers of the president's campaign remarks and suggested, if there is to be a new policy now, if an Asian war is to be converted into an American war, the country has a right to insist that it be told what has changed so profoundly in the past 2 months to justify it. Johnson was caught in a web of his own spinning. Even if he did not prefer subterfuge to frank communication, he now had no choice. Consistent with Johnson's effort to keep Vietnam out of the press, the president's top civilian advisors were determined to keep the Phase One pressures sharply limited. The Joint Chiefs continued to press for a relaxation of restrictions on military action. Their requests, however, received only partial approval from the Secretary of Defense and the President. During the month following the President's decision to begin Phase One, U.S. aircraft flew only 6 armed reconnaissance missions, spotting no enemy soldiers or military traffic. While the JCS complained that the program had fallen short of what the president had approved, McNamara and McNaughton continued to block the chief's call for further action. McNaughton argued that the purpose of the missions was to send a signal of deeper U.S. involvement, the signal to be more psychological in nature than pure military effectiveness. Although the chiefs scoffed at the idea of using military force to send signals, they remained unwilling to confront the rationale that lay behind the concept of graduated pressure or make a forceful issue of their disagreement with the Secretary of Defense or the President. Chapter 10, A Fork in the Road, December 1964 to February 1965. In retrospect, I'm absolutely convinced that we lost the war wrong. We should have fought that war in an advisory mode and remained in that mode. When the South Vietnamese failed to come up and meet the mark at the advisory level, then we never should have committed U.S. forces. We should have failed at the advisory effort and withdrawn. General Volney F. Warner, 1983. From December 1964 to February 1965, after the president had approved the report of William Bundy and his working group, a deteriorating political and military situation in South Vietnam, combined with pressure from LBJ's advisors to move LBJ toward deepening American military intervention. The planning efforts of 1964 and the president's promises of future action, which fabricated a consensus behind graduated pressure and postponed difficult decisions, had laid the foundation for the Americanization of the war. As George Ball had warned, events were now in the saddle. On December 12th, Army Chief of Staff Harold Johnson returned from a four-day trip to South Vietnam, where he visited 15 locations. At best, the general received only a superficial impression of the situation. The main purpose of his visit was to convey to a maximum number of U.S. Army personnel an appreciation of the Army Chief's keen interest in the welfare of his people and the success of the U.S. advisory and support mission in the Republic of Vietnam. In purpose and itinerary, General Johnson's trip prepared him to see only the positive aspects of the U.S. effort in Vietnam. Army advisors and staff officers who briefed the Army Chief of Staff were reluctant to bring bad news. Johnson, a compassionate leader whose principal concern was the morale of his soldiers, did not probe deeply into the reports of progress. Upon his return, the general rendered an unrealistically sanguine report to McNamara. He described various improvements in the South Vietnamese armed forces and government, lauded the accomplishments of the American military's advisory and support effort, and reported that, given political stability and popular support of the government, the positive factors on balance appear to outweigh the negative ones. They encourage some optimism about the results of programs already underway and prospects for the future. He could not have been more mistaken. When Taylor returned to Saigon, he undertook LBJ's charge to straighten out the South Vietnamese government seriously and with all the subtlety of a colonial governor. Taylor invited a score of senior South Vietnamese commanders, including a group of influential officers whom Washington officials called the Young Turks, to General Westmoreland's residence for a steak dinner, at which he told them that the United States could no longer support South Vietnam if the military continued to engage in political intrigue. He exacted from the generals a pledge to support the fledgling civilian government of Prime Minister Tran Van Hoang and his interim legislative body, the High National Council. Separately, Taylor notified Hoang that if the South Vietnamese government demonstrated minimum effectiveness, the United States would consider commencing a program of direct military pressure on North Vietnam. In the meantime, the United States would monitor the government's progress and take military actions directed toward reducing infiltration and warning the government of North Vietnam of the risks it is running. General Westmoreland's state dinner probably gave the South Vietnamese generals a bad case of indigestion. Although they depended on U.S. support, the Young Turks and their commander-in-chief, Nguyen Khan, were painfully aware of their country's historical struggle against colonial domination. These proud men resented any implication that they had become puppets of the American government, something that, in addition to a personal affront, would be a boon to communist propagandists and an obstacle to gaining popular support. Taylor incorrectly believed that his guidance had been well received. On December 20th, the Young Turks, with Khan's approval, dissolved the High National Council and arrested 22 of its members. Taylor was furious. He considered their action treachery and coming so soon after his appeal for good behavior a personal insult. Taylor called the Young Turks to his office and scolded the generals. "We cannot carry you forever if you do things like this." Addressing them in a condescending manner, he asked, "Do all of you understand English? I told you clearly at General Westmoreland's dinner, we Americans were tired of coups." The South Vietnamese generals, unaccustomed to reprimands, responded with equal vigor. Air Vice Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky told Taylor that not only did he and his colleagues understand English, but they also understood their responsibilities. "We did what we thought was good for this country." Taylor did not waver. The generals had broken a lot of dishes, and now we have to see how we can straighten out this mess. Key later recalled that he had felt like a West Point cadet being raked over the coals by the superintendent. The next day, Taylor provoked a feud with Khan that would continue until Khan's departure from the government in February 1965. 9 months had passed since Taylor, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had traveled with McNamara to Saigon to demonstrate American support for Khan as prime minister. Now Taylor told Khan that the South Vietnamese general had outlived his usefulness. When Khan, frustrated, offered to quit as commander of the South Vietnamese Armed Forces, Taylor suggested that he not only resign, but leave the country. Just before Christmas, the rift between the ambassador and the South Vietnamese military became public. Accusing Taylor of activities beyond imagination, Khan stated publicly that the ambassador was not serving his country well, and suggested privately to Premier Hoang that the South Vietnamese government declare Taylor persona non grata. On December 23rd, Taylor told Washington, "We are in the midst of a first-class governmental crisis in Saigon." He described the problem as infighting on three fronts: the government versus the generals versus the U.S. ambassador, and the Buddhists versus the government. Gone was any hope for an improvement in the South Vietnamese government during phase one of the plan Lyndon Johnson had approved 3 weeks earlier. In the midst of the turmoil in Saigon, the Viet Cong struck. On Christmas Eve, a powerful explosion destroyed the Brinks Hotel, an American bachelor officer's quarters in Saigon. Viet Cong terrorists had planted a car bomb in the parking garage. The blast killed two Americans and left 63 others injured. Taylor was anxious to launch a reprisal, but he acknowledged that several factors militated against an early decision to retaliate. Amid the turmoil in Saigon, some American officials actually suspected that South Vietnamese government agents planted the bomb. Relations were so poor with Air Vice Marshal Ky and the South Vietnamese Air Force, moreover, that any airstrike would most likely be an exclusively American operation. Taylor withheld his recommendation until he had first conducted an investigation into responsibility for the bombing. Finally, on December 28th, he recommended a retaliatory strike against North Vietnam. The Joint Chiefs quickly supported Taylor's suggestion. Wheeler asked McNamara for permission to order a reprisal raid against Taylor's preferred target, a military barracks in the southern portion of North Vietnam. Because the president was away at the Texas ranch for the holidays, Rusk presided over a meeting with Wheeler, Deputy Secretary of Defense Vance, and Forrestal. McGeorge Bundy and Rusk opposed a retaliatory strike. Bundy thought that the signal to the North Vietnamese would be blurred as long as there was such political confusion in Saigon, and that the 4-day interval since the Brinks bombing had already compromised Washington's ability to send its message. Bundy also asserted that it would be unwise to strike North Vietnam merely because security control in a U.S. bachelor's officer's quarters is bad. Bundy and Rusk's opinion prevailed, although the former included Taylor's and the chief's arguments in favor of a reprisal in a memo to the president. The two men traveled to Johnson's ranch on December 29th. The president seized on Bundy's rationale for denying a reprisal strike and sent the ambassador a cable in which he emphasized the uncertainty surrounding responsibility for the attack and the general confusion in South Vietnam. The holiday deliberations revealed that Taylor was falling out of favor with the president and his closest advisors. McGeorge Bundy and Dean Rusk openly criticized the ambassador and seemed to blame him in part for both the political crisis in Saigon and the bachelor's officers' quarters bombing. Rusk wondered if Taylor had become used up politically as a result of his clash with General Khan and the Young Turks. McGeorge Bundy questioned the objectivity of Taylor's advice. He invoked the authority of Winston Churchill to suggest that the president should never trust the man on the spot. He suggested that it was easy for Taylor to be brave, but it would be Johnson who would have to live with the decision. The Brinks bombing and the confused political situation in Saigon presented Rusk and Bundy with an opportunity to challenge Taylor's influence over Vietnam policy. Johnson sent Taylor a cable that combined an explanation of the decision to forego retaliation with a stinging critique of the ambassador's performance. The president seemed to blame Taylor and his country team for the bombing and the conditions that precluded an American reprisal. Repeating Bundy's criticism of American security arrangements, the president vowed that he would not be drawn into a large-scale military action against North Vietnam simply because our own people are careless or imprudent. Johnson told Taylor that he did not understand why aircraft cannot be protected from mortar attacks and officers' quarters from large bombs. He insinuated that Taylor had been insensitive and inept in his dealings with the various groups in South Vietnam, and expressed disappointment that Taylor had not accomplished all that he could have in the area of political persuasion with the South Vietnamese politicians and generals. The president suggested that the ambassador seek counsel from Vietnam experts who might help him deal with his present difficulties. After he admonished Taylor, Johnson enumerated conditions that would have to be met before he would look with favor on reprisal actions. These included 1. The removal of dependents. 2. The stiffening of our own security arrangements to protect our own people and forces. 3. A much wider and more varied attempt to get good political relations with all Vietnamese groups. 4. An intensified U.S. stiffening on the ground by Rangers and Special Forces or other appropriate elements. While rejecting Taylor's request for a bombing reprisal, Johnson suggested that American ground troops would be more effective in reversing the deteriorating situation. The suggestion had come from Bundy, who, as early as March 1964, had pressed Johnson to consider deploying ground troops to South Vietnam as a stiffener, not because they're needed to win the war, but only to show them that this damn thing can be done. Johnson told Taylor that he was ready to look with great favor on that kind of increased American effort, directed at the guerrillas and aimed to stiffen the aggressiveness of Vietnamese military units up and down the line. Taylor could not understand how the president could balk at what the ambassador considered a low-cost, low-risk bombing reprisal and simultaneously propose the introduction of U.S. ground forces to Vietnam. At the end of 1964, there were more than 23,000 American military advisors in South Vietnam, fighting side by side with their South Vietnamese counterparts. During 1964, 149 Americans had been killed in action, and 19 were either missing or had been captured by the enemy. The introduction of American ground combat units, however, would change the nature of U.S. involvement in the war. Vietnam would become an American war rather than a U.S. effort to help the South Vietnamese fight their own conflict. Although McNamara would write in 1995 that the president's suggestion for ground troops came out of the blue, the Secretary of Defense and the Executive Committee had considered the introduction of ground troops as part of Option C during their deliberations in November 1964. On November 24th, Rusk and McGeorge Bundy expressed an interest in the deployment of ground forces as a signal of determination on the part of the United States. McNamara disagreed and argued that ground troops were not needed under his proposal for graduated pressure against the North. McNamara carried the argument, and the working group's final draft reflected his assessment. In his November 26 memo, William Bundy observed that by deploying ground troops early in the game of graduated pressure, the United States would play a card that we might wish to hold in reserve for a later stage. After Taylor arrived in Washington, the ground troop issue was suppressed completely. Like McNamara, the ambassador remained opposed to American ground combat units in Vietnam. William Bundy's National Security Action Memorandum on Vietnam did not mention the deployment of ground troops. As William Bundy subsequently stated, McNamara and Taylor guaranteed that the issue simply died away. Although Rusk and McGeorge Bundy had deferred to McNamara and Taylor in early December, they had the opportunity to suggest ground troops directly to the president during a trip to Texas in the wake of the Brinks bombing, when Taylor's opinions were most vulnerable to rejection. The president's casual proposal to deploy ground troops reflected thinking that ground forces could be used in much the same way as air power. During the November 1964 deliberations, Robert H. Johnson of the State Department's Policy Planning Council and Paul Kattenberg, also of the State Department, advocated the introduction of ground combat units into South Vietnam as an alternative to bombing North Vietnam. Ground forces would be deployed not with the mission to defeat the enemy on the battlefield, but to coerce Hanoi into negotiations designed to extricate the United States from its commitment to South Vietnam. Johnson and Kattenberg predicted that the presence of ground forces would forecast to the North Vietnamese the likelihood of a much longer and costly war. They thought that they could maintain tight control over ground forces, just as they planned to do over airstrikes. Robert Johnson suggested that ground forces could undertake limited military action to turn military pressure off and on during negotiations. Like the threat of continued bombing, ground forces such as the 1st Marine Division and advanced elements of the Army's 82nd Airborne Division could serve as a bargaining lever in these hypothetical negotiations. Johnson and Kattenberg suggested that ground combat units would convince North Vietnam to desist from its support of the insurgency in the South because, unlike airstrikes, which would have to stop once negotiations had begun, ground forces could not readily be removed by international pressures and negotiations. The chairman of the Policy Planning Council, Walt Rostow, agreed with their assessment. In a letter to McNamara on November 13th, Rostow had argued that ground troops can sit during a conference more easily than we can maintain a series of mounting air and naval pressures. During negotiations, the United States could take the reasonable position that it would remove ground forces when North Vietnam had pledged to end its support for the insurgency in the South. As he composed a six-part telegram responding to the president's cable, Taylor was besieged on all fronts. He received information that suggested an impending collapse of the American position in South Vietnam. While South Vietnamese generals occupied themselves principally with political intrigue, the Viet Cong were growing stronger to a point where they controlled half of the countryside and one quarter of the rural population. They had infiltrated the once safe major cities and seemed poised to cut off the northern portion of South Vietnam by driving from their highland bases to the coastal provinces on the South China Sea. The pacification program that Westmoreland had hoped would secure the area around Saigon and serve as a model for the entire country had come to a standstill. The South Vietnamese armed forces were exclusively on the defensive and had suffered major defeats in spite of their superiority in numbers and equipment. Morale was sagging. In January alone, more than 7,000 South Vietnamese deserted from the ranks. Taylor, however, never considered re-examining the U.S. commitment to South Vietnam. He later recalled that there were many untried military and other possibilities for improving the situation. With the South Vietnamese government in disarray and its armed forces on the ropes, it was time for the pulmotor treatment that Taylor had predicted might become necessary to revive an expiring South Vietnam. After reaffirming his advocacy of bombing, Taylor explained in great detail why deploying ground combat units to Vietnam would be a grave mistake. First, the United States had gone about as far down the advisory route as it is practical to go without passing the point of clearly diminishing returns. After much soul-searching, Taylor and Westmoreland concluded that any military advantages gained as a result of the introduction of ground forces would be more than offset by the political liabilities. Taylor argued that the South Vietnamese had the physical and logistical capability to win the war, but lacked the motivation to fight effectively. In light of the massive advisory effort that the United States had undertaken over the past 10 years, it seemed unlikely that the introduction of U.S. combat forces would inspire the South Vietnamese to press the war more vigorously. On the contrary, he argued, U.S. combat forces would simply encourage the South Vietnamese armed forces to let the United States carry the full burden of the war effort. He feared that large numbers of U.S. ground troops would raise the specter of French colonialism and encourage a majority of the population to turn against the United States. Ultimately, Taylor predicted, U.S. soldiers and Marines would find themselves occupying a hostile foreign country. Taylor also considered the introduction of ground forces too expensive in money, manpower, and public opinion. General Westmoreland estimated that it would take 34 battalions or 75,000 troops to provide security to U.S. personnel and facilities. The ambassador observed that it would be difficult to confine Americans to their secure enclaves in the face of guerrilla attacks and predicted that ground units would inevitably have to expand operations beyond defensive perimeters. Due to the expanding mission, Taylor argued that the ultimate cost in U.S. forces would be unpredictable and warned that U.S. casualties would be high. Offensive operations outside the enclaves would inevitably kill South Vietnamese civilians, casualties that would increase anti-American sentiment and give appearances of a white man's war against the brown. The tactical operations conducted over the previous 2 years revealed that, due to the guerrilla nature of the fighting, it would rarely be feasible to use large U.S. combat formations in battle. Although Taylor objected to the introduction of ground combat units, he observed that the current situation in Vietnam demanded some sort of action. We are presently on a losing track and must risk a change. He rejected the president's hint that old Vietnam hands like General Edward Lansdale and CIA Station Chief Lucien Cunin might assist him. No one would be able to change national characteristics, create leadership where it does not exist, raise large additional combat forces, or seal porous frontiers to infiltration. Improvements in these areas would take time. South Vietnam might collapse in the very near term. The president and other senior officials in Washington should be satisfied with a marginal government and add a new element to American policy to compensate for those factors that were beyond American control. Taylor urged the United States to look for an occasion to conduct a reprisal airstrike and set the stage for Phase 2 continuing actions against the North. The U.S. government could justify systematic bombing to the American public by publicizing reports of North Vietnamese infiltration into the South and by provoking a North Vietnamese attack on U.S. destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. As for the president's concerns that air power could not win the war in the South, graduated pressure would influence the North Vietnamese leaders, who were practical men. Faced with the prospect of damage from the air, they would try to find some accommodations which will excise that threat. On January 6th, the president met with Rusk, Ball, and McNamara to discuss Taylor's cable and the situation in Vietnam. No military leader was present. Rusk argued that the United States had to make the current policy of supporting South Vietnam work because the alternatives are so grim. Ball appeared almost resigned to defeat, but he agreed with Rusk that we should make a heroic effort, but not delude ourselves about a regime that had the smell of death. Lyndon Johnson committed himself to a reprisal against North Vietnam after the next raid on American forces or facilities. Perhaps to assuage Taylor's feelings after the highly critical cable sent earlier, Lyndon Johnson thanked Taylor for his exceedingly helpful and thoughtful analysis of the situation. Johnson told Taylor that the United States would reply by air to the next act of aggression against U.S. personnel and equipment, although he doubted that bombing would raise South Vietnam's morale. He was not yet willing, however, to commit to the timing and scale of Phase 2 graduated pressures on North Vietnam. William Bundy and McNaughton, meanwhile, shared Ball's feeling that although the United States should deepen its military involvement in Vietnam, it should be prepared to accept defeat. Despite their doubts that military force would secure American objectives in Vietnam, McNaughton and Bundy found the commitment of U.S. ground combat units to be an attractive option. On January 4th, McNaughton restated his belief that the important stakes in Vietnam were the buffer real estate near Thailand and Malaysia, and our reputation. He felt that America's reputation would suffer least if it continued to support South Vietnam. Even if the United States did not reverse the tide, a failure after deeper American involvement would permit a departure of the kind which would put everyone on our side, wondering how we stuck it out and took it so long. Besides, if things slipped, McNaughton had plans to shore up Thailand and Malaysia. The Secretary of Defense concluded that a loss at the current level of commitment would be worse than failure after the commitment of hundreds of thousands of American soldiers, airmen, and Marines. On January 6th, just before Rusk met with the president, William Bundy handed him a memo in which he and Forrestal concluded, like McNaughton, that stronger action would put the United States in a better position to hold the next line of defense. The application of bombing pressure on North Vietnam would have appeared to Asians to have been the Americans' best shot. As Bundy later recalled his thinking, if, as appeared quite possible, South Vietnam was too far gone to save, nonetheless, a final additional American effort would greatly increase the chances of holding the line at Thailand, the fallback geographical bastion, and, as it increasingly appeared, the psychological key to the rest of mainland Southeast Asia, at least. Like McNaughton, Bundy was not opposed to the deployment of ground troops to keep up appearances. As his brother had suggested earlier, Bundy thought that ground combat units introduced at the outset of bombing the North might have a real stiffening effect in Saigon and a strong signal effect to Hanoi. The Joint Chiefs had accepted the strategy of gradual application of force in Vietnam on the condition that once U.S. forces became directly involved in the war, the U.S. government would pursue its stated policy goals and objectives without qualification. The president and his civilian advisors did not intend to fulfill this condition. The advisors also had developed among themselves, they thought, a Southeast Asia policy that allowed them to work within Johnson's domestic political constraints and achieve their political international goals. They consequently circumvented the chiefs rather than allowing them to plan for the deployment of American ground troops. Although Taylor persuaded Lyndon Johnson not to use ground troops in the near term, he was unable to hold the president to this position in the long run. Johnson's closest advisors, who had already voiced doubts about Taylor's effectiveness, continued to undercut the ambassador's influence. McGeorge Bundy, pointing to his own 3-year experience as an Army staff officer, suggested that Taylor and Westmoreland, as regulation officers, were running operations in Vietnam in a regulation way, with too much staff, too much administration, too much clerical work, too much reporting, too much rotation, and not enough action. Rusk shared Bundy's doubts about Taylor. He and others suggested that only Taylor's assistant, U. Alexis Johnson, kept the Saigon embassy functioning effectively. By the end of January, rumors of the attacks on Taylor had reached Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. Kennedy warned him of an effort on behalf of at least some important segments of the administration to place the blame on you for the difficulties in Vietnam. Policy differences, particularly over the use of ground troops in Vietnam, in part underlay the opposition to Taylor. McGeorge Bundy, consistent with the views of his brother, rejected Taylor's argument that ground combat units should not be introduced into Vietnam at an early date. He suggested to the president that McNamara opposed sending more American soldiers to Vietnam only because he believed that a larger number of troops would mean more overhead and administration and general heaviness. On January 7th, Bundy drafted for Johnson a memo to McNamara, suggesting that he develop a new plan for volunteer fighting forces that would proceed with minimum of overhead and a maximum of energy in direct contact with the Vietnamese at all levels. The memo directed McNamara to develop some alternatives for the employment of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam. Bundy had LBJ attach to the memorandum a copy of a U.S. News and World Report article critical of Taylor's and Westmoreland's operation in Saigon. As McGeorge Bundy and Rusk chipped away at Taylor's and McNamara's influence with the president, the JCS remained excluded from the president's review of Vietnam policy. The president and his closest advisors did not solicit military advice on either the introduction of ground forces or Taylor's recommendation to begin a regular bombing campaign. Someone aware of their frustration leaked a story that was published in the London Times on January 18th. The uniformed military had been excluded from the inner councils in Washington. One of Bundy's staff, received a copy of the article and warned him that there is considerable concern in the JCS about their exclusion from these Vietnam meetings. Since the joint staff is frequently asked for briefing materials, General Wheeler is well aware that the meetings are taking place. There may be a good reason for excluding Wheeler, but I wonder whether it outweighs the disadvantages that might arise from his absence. I know this is McNamara's problem, not yours, but you might want to raise the issue with him. In his memoir, McNamara wrote that Johnson was frustrated by the shallowness of advice that the JCS sent him. McNamara himself, however, was largely responsible for the inadequacy of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's counsel, and therefore for the president's frustration. Excluded from substantive deliberations on Vietnam, the JCS continued to try to erode the barriers to more resolute military action and to prepare for a larger American military commitment. General Wheeler, disappointed in the decision to forego retaliation for the Brinks bombing, moved to guarantee that future incidents would precipitate a retaliatory airstrike. He sent a cable to General Westmoreland and Admiral Sharp, expressing astonishment at the argument that lax security not only invites, but in some curious way justifies a Viet Cong attack and thereby inhibits us from retaliatory action. Sharp and Westmoreland must somehow convince the Washington policymakers that our security arrangements are as good as the type of war we are fighting will permit. Hurdles to direct American action against North Vietnam should be reduced, and the commanders should be ready to conduct reprisals. U.S. dependents should be evacuated to preclude them from hindering action against the North. Finally, Wheeler asked Westmoreland to press the military and civilians in Saigon to submerge their differences and fabricate a reasonably sound governmental structure. Wheeler and the JCS now sought an increased level of military activity as a goal in itself. On January 15th, the chiefs reminded McNamara that the period allocated for Phase 1 pressures had elapsed, and at their suggestion, he permitted the use of U.S. jet aircraft within South Vietnam, subject to Ambassador Taylor's approval. They urged a resumption of destroyer patrols in the Gulf of Tonkin and prepared a series of reprisal options aimed at low-value military targets. Their reprisal packages were designed to appeal to Washington officials' penchant for control and for limiting the scale of airstrikes. Through an Air Force colonel on the National Security Council staff, the chiefs requested the relaxation of geographic restrictions on Operation Barrel Roll, the airstrikes in Laos. The JCS responded to civil unrest in South Vietnam by preparing to intervene directly on the ground. From January 23rd to 25th, Buddhist uprisings in major South Vietnamese cities unmasked strong anti-American sentiments. The Buddhists directed assaults against symbols of the American presence in South Vietnam. In Hue, the center of the unrest, students sacked the United States Information Service Library. Demonstrators shouted, "Taylor, go home," and Buddhist leaders denounced Premier Huang as the ambassador's lackey. On January 25th, the JCS ordered an amphibious readiness group to move within 24 hours striking distance of Da Nang, and two naval task groups to move to a location 6 hours away from Saigon. Although the crisis passed, it showed that concerns over the security of American citizens and property might easily overwhelm Taylor's objections to the introduction of ground combat forces. McNamara resisted the chief's request for further action, although he was willing to make minor concessions. On January 13th, the chiefs asked McNamara to approve the deployment of a 6,200-man Army Logistical Command in Vietnam to prepare for the possibility of large-scale troop deployments. McNamara, who had ordered McNaughton to hold the line on the numbers of U.S. troops in Vietnam, sent a Defense Department team to Saigon to study the request, which Westmoreland had initiated. The team notified Westmoreland's staff that they would approve 125 logistical troops, and if MACV used them properly, 250 more. The team's odd decision reflected McNamara's attempt to accede to the military's request on the one hand, and his belief that introducing more U.S. troops in Vietnam was as likely to be counterproductive as productive on the other. The defense secretary, who in November had helped suppress discussion on the introduction of ground troops, thought that applying pressure to North Vietnam would solve the problems in South Vietnam. He only had to pull the president away from his preoccupation with the Great Society and force him to decide to implement Phase 2. Johnson's preoccupation with his domestic legislative program led him to obscure from the public and the Congress the extent of the difficulties in Vietnam. Despite his efforts to suppress the stories, however, newspapers had carried front-page articles on the U.S. ambassador's row with the South Vietnamese generals and on the military defeats suffered by the South Vietnamese army at the hands of the Viet Cong. On January 21st, Johnson arranged a meeting with key Democratic and Republican members of the House and Senate. The meeting convened as General Khan was charging the administration with grossly understating the degree of communist infiltration from North Vietnam. Coincidentally, the purpose of the meeting with the legislators was to propagate the administration's spuriously optimistic assessment. On the first day of his four-year term, Johnson hid the truth about Vietnam for the sake of a domestic political agenda. McNamara assisted his dissembling. For those who might urge the administration to take additional action against North Vietnam, McNamara indicated that tough measures were already underway. He divulged the nature of covert operations against North Vietnam under Op Plan 34A and revealed that U.S. aircraft were bombing infiltration routes in Laos under Operation Barrel Roll. Contrary to reality, he depicted both operations as highly successful. For those wary of deepening U.S. involvement, McNamara struck a note of reassurance. He suggested, contrary to recent reports from the field, that the South Vietnamese Army had increased its effectiveness in response to increases in the size and strength of the Viet Cong. He misrepresented the chief's assessments of the situation, stating that they believed that the South Vietnamese armed forces were stronger than a year before. For those who feared that the American commitment to Vietnam had grown too costly, he minimized the price of American involvement. McNamara stated that only 254 Americans had been killed in action there in the past decade, without mentioning that more than half of the American combat deaths in Vietnam had occurred within the last year. He did not disclose plans to begin reprisal bombing of North Vietnam and stated that there would be no need for U.S. troops. The president reinforced McNamara's effort. At the end of the meeting, he interjected that he and his advisors had decided that more U.S. forces are not needed in South Vietnam, short of a decision to go to full-scale war. Johnson emphasized that the war must be fought by the South Vietnamese. We cannot control everything that they do, and we have to count on their fighting the war. The day following the meeting, the New York Times reported that the president and top administration officials had engaged the representatives and senators in a very frank and thorough discussion of the international situation. The disparity between the administration's declarations and the truth necessitated tight control over the military's access to the press. 2 days after the meeting with congressional leaders, an Associated Press story recounted senior naval officers' views on the president's Vietnam policy. The report that some officers in the 7th Fleet believe the United States has lost face in Vietnam for stopping destroyer patrols in the Tonkin Gulf, undermined official government pronouncements that the United States had continued its patrols since the incidents in August and September 1964. In response, McNamara ordered Commander-in-Chief Pacific, or CINCPAC, to deny that the official policy had changed, and to ban media representatives from naval operational units and sensitive installations –